The Cycling Podcast, in association with Rafa. From grand tours to group rides, the Champs-Élysées to coffee shops, Rafa exists to celebrate the world's most beautiful sport.
Hello, my name is Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And Daniel Freeb.
Hello, chaps.
Hello. It's been a while, fellas. Only a fortnight. Seems like longer.
Where you been? Where you been, Rich?
Well, as if you haven't been tuning in every night, Daniel, to our coverage of the women's tour last week.
I might have been.
Nightly episodes. You might have even got a mention or two. I can imagine our stage four coverage may have been difficult for you to listen to. With our now infamous water feature.
Toilet issues, Daniel's least favourite subject.
You can go back and listen to that one, Daniel. It generated a lot of feedback.
You were in my neck of the woods, weren't you, at some point? Warwickshire?
Now I know you weren't listening, Daniel. Now I know you weren't listening. Or you're just pretending. Yeah, we were indeed. That was the literary stage because we were in the land of two real heavyweights, William Shakespeare and Daniel Freeb. And we paid homage to both of them in our coverage of that stage.
Yeah, Daniel Freeb's book about Jan Ullrich, Much Ado About Nothing, is coming along, I think. Is it, Daniel? Reverse bullying. Sorry, Daniel.
moving on.
Where exactly did the stage finish? Was it Atherstone? Because I'm not really...
No, it started in Atherstone and finished in Royal Leamington Spa.
Oh,
that
okay, yeah, so it was my neck of the woods. Okay.
Yeah, very much so. We skirted around Coventry and we were thinking about you a lot that day, Daniel, especially in our
good
water feature.
Good.
Which we were doing interviews for that day. Anyway, there has been a lot of racing and we've got a lot to catch up on, haven't we? And we're looking ahead to the Tour de France already. It's coming, it's looming on the horizon. Lionel, news roundup, please. And you've got a lot to live up to here because the news roundups have just been
all as odyssey.
They've gone to a whole new level.
Yeah, I'm not. What am I going to slot in? 70s game show host names slotted into the news roundup.
Here we go.
Well, just before you headed off to the women's tour, Richard, Geraint Thomas won the Critérium du Dauphiné, clinching victory by a minute over another British rider, Adam Yates of Mitchelton Scott. Roman Bardet was third and Dan Martin was fourth, so they're all preparing well for the Tour de France. Yates and Martin won two of the uphill finishes in the second half of the race. Pello Bilbao of Astana also won a stage in the mountains. Meanwhile, in the other big Tour de France preparation race, the Tour of Switzerland, Richie Port won overall for BMC Racing. They'd already got the race off to a great start by winning the team time trial at the start. And in fact bookended the race with another TT victory because Stefan Kung won the individual test at the end of the race. Peter Sagan, Sonny Colbrelli and Arno Demar won sprint stages. Chris Juul Jensen, Diego Ulissi and Søren Krag Andersen enjoyed breakaway success and the big mountain stage was won by Nairo Quintana. And Quintana clinched third place overall behind Port and the runner-up Jakob Fuglsang. Meanwhile, Primoz Roglic won his home stage race, the Tour of Slovenia, ahead of Rigoberto Urán and Matej Mohoric. And Alejandro Valverde won the Route de Occitanie, which used to be known as the Route du Sud. There was also a victory there for Cofidis sprinter Nasser Bouhanni, who won't have done his chances of selection for the Tour any harm. From here, all roads lead to the Tour de France then, via the national championships, which take place over the next couple of weekends. I say all roads lead to the Tour, although that's not the case for Thibaut Pinot of Groupama FDJ, who is recovering from the pneumonia which forced him out of the Giro d'Italia at the end of the race. Off the bike, Team Sky's Gianni Moscon is free to race on after a hearing cleared him of deliberately knocking off Sebastian Reichenbach at the Tre Valli Varesine one-day race in Italy last October. Reichenbach broke his elbow and fractured his hip in the crash, and the allegation was that Moscon knocked him off in response to Reichenbach accusing him of using racist language towards Kevin Reiser in the Tour of Romandy earlier in the year. But with no video evidence of the incident, the UCI's disciplinary commission cleared Moscon. Meanwhile, five-time Tour de France winner Bernard Hinault has done little to quell the controversy over Chris Froome's participation in the Tour as the salbutamol case continues without resolution. Eno has called on other riders in the peloton to strike if Froome starts the Tour. And Vuelta a España director Javier Guillén has also called for the case to be decided as soon as possible. He wants the winner of the 2017 race to be confirmed one way or the other before this year's edition gets underway in August. Finally, the women's tour was won by Corinne Rivera of Sunweb. And if you didn't listen to the episodes from the race with Richard, Orla Shenoui and Rose Manley, do go back and listen because they covered so much more than just what happened on the road.
A community around the world. Stories and films with the most compelling characters. The world's finest apparel. Explore the world of cycling with Rafa.
Thank you very much to our main sponsor, Rafa, for their continued support of the cycling podcast. I should mention that we were shadowed by the Rafa Race Radio team on the final day of the women's tour, Orla, myself and Rose Manley. And they produced a short film about their day at the women's tour, and we feature in that. Fortunately, they don't make us look like complete idiots. So you'll find that on the Rafa YouTube channel. And yeah, thank you very much again to Rafa for sponsoring the cycling podcast. Thank you very much for that very business-like news roundup there, Lionel. Hope you up your game for the Tour de France. People are listening. We've got certain expectations.
The tail of the attack, maybe I'll come up with something. A device for the tail of the attack, just to liven it up and keep listeners on their toes.
But the Dauphiné you mentioned there, and that has been, we're kind of a little bit behind with that, but always a significant warm-up, tune-up race for the Tour de France. Not sure if it was so much this year. Interesting to see some of the leading riders split more this year between the Dauphiné and the Tour of Switzerland, because Switzerland has been the poor relation the last few years. But the Dauphiné, Geraint Thomas was the winner, as you say. Daniel, you were there. I mean, I suppose Geraint Thomas is one story, and then at the other end of the spectrum is Vincenzo Nibali. Would we not have expected Nibali to go into that race and contend for the win if we're going to see him as a challenger at the Tour de France?
I would suggest not, Rich. I think he finished seventh in 2014 in the Dauphiné, and of course went on to win the Tour de France that year, and has had a pretty low-key last month or so. I think he's been on the Teide volcano with Sky and Geraint Thomas at the same time that they were there. I asked Geraint Thomas what kind of interaction he had with Nibali and the Bahrain Merida riders when they were up there, and he pretty much said none at all. They give each other a nod over the breakfast buffet, but that's about it. And yeah, they certainly came into the Dauphiné in contrasting state or form. Thomas obviously flying. We could tell that straight from the prologue when he crashed and still only lost about 20 seconds to his teammate Michał Kwiatkowski. And then, you know, looking at the route, it was four summit finishes that concluded the race, so it didn't look as though it would suit Thomas particularly well. It was really going to be probably the biggest test he's had as a general classification rider of his career. And he sailed through, really, partly, I think, on the, well, buoyed by that form that he had, that fantastic form, and also a really brilliant team performance, or certainly by a couple of his riders, a couple of his domestiques. Theo Gegenhardt, friend of the podcast, was, by most people's reckoning, the man of the match on at least a couple of those stages in the mountains. And they
put that gap here to good use, didn't
they? Well, he did. And AG2R came at them pretty hard. AG2R were one of the few teams, as you would expect a French team, really still treating the Dauphiné like a tune-up for the Tour de France. And they came in with what is likely to be something like their tour team. And they had a good go. Bardet was very aggressive. But Bardet, again, a bit like when he came up against Chris Froome in the Alps last year in the Tour de France, he's very consistent. He does ride aggressively, but there is, I suppose, still a question mark over whether he has that sort of turbo boost which will allow him to drop and put a minute or a minute and a half into people, which is what he's going to need, because he's always going to be penalised by his time trialing. I mean, there was a much better performance by AG2R in the team time trial in the Dauphiné than we've seen from them in the past two or three years, and that's where you would expect that to be the case, because they've added a couple of riders this year. Tony Gallopin has come in, and he's he's obviously a strong engine. Pierre Latour is a year stronger than he was last year, and he won the white jersey as well at the Dauphiné. So they should be better in a team time trial. And of course, there's a 35-kilometre team time trial in the Tour de France in Cholet, but he will lose time there, we think, to Sky. And they certainly, you know, they lost a good chunk of time at the Dauphiné. I mean, there are a few murmurs of discontent from fans and pundits and even other riders about the team time trial sort of, well, not falsifying the result of the Dauphiné, but certainly dictating the way it was ridden for the rest of the week. It basically gave Sky and Thomas a big advantage, which they could then defend. But I thought that set up quite a good race because, you know, Thomas's ability to defend a lead in the mountains was under scrutiny prior to that. Not that many people would have thought that he could successfully defend a yellow jersey against Bardet and some of the other top climbers in the race, but he did. So it was a pretty decent spectacle, all in all.
Geraint Thomas, is that his best performance and result, Lionel?
I think so. It's another notch and a half up from Paris-Nice win, isn't it? Because of the difficulty of the second half of the race, the fact that he fell off in the opening time trial and that could have been the end of his race, but wasn't. I get what people were saying there about the team time trial, because it really did hammer home Sky's superiority, and it was an absolutely perfect pre-season friendly for the Tour de France, wasn't it? And I think the main takeaway from the Dauphiné is that Sky are going to go into the race with Geraint Thomas as a very viable second option to Chris Froome, not least because the cobbled stage is not going to upset Thomas as much as it might upset Chris Froome, so it's going to be interesting.
But Napalm, I mean that was reiterated throughout the week by Thomas and by Team Sky's management that he is, well, they've used different terms, that they've used the word, I think, deputy leader or joint leader, but practically speaking, I'm just not sure how that's going to work, because especially with 8 riders in the teams now, of course it's 1 rider less than it has been in previous tours. How practically do you work that if, for example, you mentioned the cobbled stage, if Thomas is having a good day and Froome is not, and Froome needs some help, and you know, some of the other guys have been picked for their ability on the flat, on the cobbles, and not having a good day either. I mean, what happens in that situation?
Well, you remember in 2010 there was a cobbled stage. Geraint Thomas was actually second on that cobbled stage. Maybe not quite as hard, but still hard, and big splits that day. That was the day that Lance Armstrong came out with his memorable quote, "Sometimes you're the hammer, sometimes you're the nail," at the end. And there were big splits that day. Now, that was Team Sky's first year, and Bradley Wiggins was left behind. He had a few problems. Geraint Thomas wasn't told to wait for him, but Steve Cummings, who was also in that group, was. I imagine that in that scenario this year, Geraint Thomas would not be required to wait for Chris Froome if there was a problem with Froome. He would be basically allowed to ride his own race that day, because that's the stage also he could win.
Yeah, I completely agree with you, Rich, because if you think about the layout of the race, I know because the rest day comes after the cobbled stage and then it's straight into a run of alpine stages, you kind of think that the cobbled stage is the sort of the end of phase one of the race, but really it's the day before the mountain, so it would be absolutely balmy to sacrifice Geraint Thomas for Chris Froome if, you know, the scenario played out that way, particularly when you consider the likely strength of Sky's team when it comes to climbing. Wout Poels, Jani Moscon, Michał Kwiatkowski, even Egan Bernal. I mean, they're not even going to need to get down to Geraint Thomas riding on the front until very, very late on in these mountain stages. So he can almost be protected up to the point that he goes pop himself, I would have thought.
I'm not sure, Napalm, because, well, if you think of the way that Team Sky like to ride, they fan off, you know, each climber will do whatever he can on the front and they'll peel off one by one by one. And, you know, there have been isolated examples where they've managed to keep both guys up there. For example, Axe Trois-Domaines with Richie Porte and Chris Froome in 2013, and it looked as though Porte was going to be in for the long haul. He was going to potentially contend for second place or be there should Froome falter, but the reality was that it just proved very difficult to implement, because generally the second last or the last domestique is required to bury himself for the leader at some point. And, you know, when you've got a guy who's going for his fifth Tour de France win, like Froome is, I just think that it'd be very difficult for Geraint Thomas to turn around and say, well, no, you know, I'm protecting my own chances as well. I don't know. I'm intrigued.
It might come to that. Yeah, it will. It will maybe come to that. But I think certainly the first half of the race, they can keep their options open.
We're deep into the realms of speculation here, but I think Sky have got enough. You know, Gianni Moscon. How many people do you need really to try and pull Chris Froome back into contention? I mean, we're talking as if Froome's had a shocker on the second cobbled section, and he's already distanced. We just don't know how that stage is going to play out. But I would say history kind of tells you that it's quite good to have somebody highly placed overall anyway. And I wouldn't have thought that Sky or any team would toss away a highly placed position on GC, particularly with you know, not knowing how all the mountains will play out. But it's going to be interesting to see how the teams all approach that cobbled stage, because there's a lot more to lose than there is to gain on that day, that's for sure.
Just two final points on this issue, Chas. I mean, I think that the reduction in the team size does make it harder. It's definitely going to be harder to go in with just eight riders plus, and two of them as co-leaders. I think already we've seen, well, we saw in the Giro, the workload is being spread more thickly across the domestique, so they're having to do more, so they're going to have to put in a real shift for both Thomas and Froome. The second point is, and again, we're in the realms of speculation here, Napalm, but is it possible that this co-leadership has been dangled as a carrot in front of Geraint Thomas in exchange for him possibly renewing his contract with Sky, which they want him to do, and I think he's hesitating over.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, Cycling Podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's the siren and voice of Seb Piquet, race radio on the Tour de France, to remind me to tell you that this episode of the Cycling Podcast is supported by The Economist. And all of you out there, our listeners, can get a free print copy of The Economist. And we'll tell you how to do that in just a moment. But The Economist is about far more than just economics and finance. It covers a range of subjects from politics and business to science, technology, the arts and the environment. It helps readers prepare for what is going on in the world around them. And in today's dynamic world, facts matter more than ever. For 170 years, The Economist has delivered trustworthy intelligence that helps people like you to choose where to stand on the issues that matter most. Now, Rich, you've been looking through your copy of The Economist this week. What's caught your eye?
Well, Lionel, it's a very pertinent article about the speed limit in France being reduced from July the 1st, just in time for my arrival. I think that's a coincidence. But the speed limit on single carriageway rural roads will be reduced from 90 kilometres per hour to 80 kilometres per hour, which they reckon will save 300 and 400 lives a year, which is quite remarkable. The Economist goes into just how speed limits are set. There are a couple of articles in recent editions. I find it fascinating because I didn't know this. I mean, we know how many people are killed on the roads. It's the world's eighth biggest cause of death. In America, 40,000 people were killed on the roads in 2016. But what I didn't know was that the way that speed limits are set, the main factor which authorities look at is how fast people drive, and the speed limits are set at the 85th percentile of prevailing speeds, which I thought was very interesting. So really the speed limit is determined by the behaviour of drivers.
That's the tail wagging the dog to an extent, isn't it? I have to say, we cover a lot of kilometres on French roads, and particularly on sort of rural roads as well,
don't
we?
And always stay within the speed limit.
Yeah, but you do see some pretty shocking driving, and when you're out in La France Profonde and you're on those roads, you can be pretty remote, and an accident. I sometimes think when you see a car kind of overtaking, coming towards you, particularly on those tree-lined roads, you think, well, there's an accident waiting to happen with the speed that some people drive at. So I think reducing the speed limit on those kind of roads, definitely a good move for the French.
There's a sort of cost-benefit analysis carried out by the authorities, and, you know, it's interesting that Britain sets the price of a life just below the French level of €3 million, and It's just fascinating that you sort of take these things for granted and don't really think about the process that's led to these. You think they're almost quite arbitrary, but they're not. France is up in arms about this. The French are not happy, especially rural France. Over 2 million people have signed a petition to protest. 86% of rural folk are against the reduction in the speed limit.
But how many times have you signed that petition, Richard?
Anyway, how will people get a copy of The Economist?
Well, The Economist is a smart guide to the forces changing your world, and you can get a free copy now. For your free print copy of The Economist, just text cycling to 78070. That's cycling to 78070.
So just before we move on to the Tour of Switzerland and Richie Porte's victory there, much needed by him, I suspect, a few little pieces of business. Just want to mention the Women's Tour. It was the first time we've given that daily coverage. We had 250,000 listens over the 6 episodes that we produced, which was beyond our expectations, I think. And it was great fun to do, and it got a great response. So thank you, everybody that listened, and thank you to our sponsors, Rafa, Science and Sport, and Skoda, who are now sponsoring the Cycling Podcast Femina for the rest of the year as well. So very, very, very grateful to all of them. And it was a great experience, and we want to build on that. So stay tuned. An event that we're doing that I want to mention, we haven't mentioned this yet, but we're doing an event on the rest day at the Tour de France, the first rest day, on Monday the 16th of July in Annecy. Our friends at Base Camp are hosting us. That's just outside Annecy. It's a free event, first come, first serve basis. You'll find details of the event at the Base Camp Facebook page. It's called An Evening with the Cycling Podcast. They'll be doing specials on food and drink on the night. You could also mention, I'm told, that we will be doing rides from Base Camp every day of the Tour de France and showing the race in the cafe live every afternoon.
And the following night, we will be doing something very similar at the Chalet Le Giertaz, which is where we stayed a couple of years ago, Rich, if you remember.
Indeed.
And I gather all the accommodation is sold out at the chalet, but there may be some places available. Keep an eye on our Twitter and Facebook pages over the next 48 hours, and we'll post some details if there are any places available for that on, I think that's July the 17th.
Yep, and just back to the Annecy event, if you can't find their event on Facebook, just email us contact@thiscyclingpodcast.com and we will forward your email to them and register you for a place there. Hope to see a few there. It'll be myself, Lionel, Francois, Tomaso, and perhaps Orla Shinoui as well, because Orla is coming out for La Course, which is the following day, the Tuesday.
Last time I saw you in Annecy, Rich, you were hobbling across a nightclub dance floor.
That's right, Daniel. That's right, yeah. We went for a cycling holiday there a few years ago. What year was that? 2009,
2009.
Yeah. Wow. Happy days.
Wow.
But a lot of hobbling.
We were young and carefree.
Well, I'm not sure about that.
You
either.
Were not I'm carefree, not, no.
Or young,
you not carefree.
Or particularly young. But anyway, all good fun. Let's find that dance floor again.
Rich has got the hips of Chuck Berry.
Well, I did have
same
then.
Age.
I've now got a new one since then, so no more hobbling. I should have mentioned this in connection with the Women's Tour coverage, but just today, that's Wednesday, we've released a short Friends special. Orla spent a day with the Trek Drops team in the team car, and we did play a little bit of her day inside the car in an episode during the race, on stage 3 I think it was. But she came back with, in typical Orla fashion, with a lot more recorded material. And so we were able to put that together into a 25-minute special episode. And I think it's absolutely riveting. It's mainly off the back of the race, helping Manon Lloyd, who'd had a bad crash, get back up to the Gruppetto. She actually had a broken bone in her pelvis that she didn't know about at the time. But she finished the stage, and it's really great. And we hear her sports director Bob Varney encouraging her and supporting her, and it's a really great insight into a side of the race that we never see. So that's available for Friends of the Podcast. Lionel, you have also made a Friends of the Podcast special that's gone out this week.
Yes, I went to interview Colin Sturgis, a name that may be familiar to some listeners who were following cycling in the late 80s, 90s. He rode the Olympics in Seoul for Great Britain and finished fourth, and then the following year, once he turned professional, he won the World Professional Individual Pursuit championship on the track, rode for the ADR team, was a teammate of Greg LeMond's for a little while. And, well, I don't want to spoil the episode because there's an awful lot in it. It's split into two parts. The first part largely deals with Durgis's racing career, and the second part is more about his life off the bike. And he talks very openly about his mental health and his battle with bipolar condition over the years. Let's hear a little bit from that conversation.
30 years ago, Colin Sturgis was 19 years old and preparing to ride the individual pursuit at the Seoul Olympics.
Relied on my super fast finish. It's just the way I used to ride pursuits. Suited me, suited my style, suited my low gears. I rode phenomenally low gears. For those that like looking at gear charts and things like that, you know, the biggest gear I rode in the Olympics was 50-15, which is 90 inches. I mean, nowadays that wouldn't even be a training gear. You know, you'd have schoolboys and schoolgirls riding around on that. I just remember seeing Heiko, the East German coach at the time, at the side of the track, just absolutely beside himself because he realised that Dieter was, you know, under attack.
It'll be the bell this time. There it is. The bell sounds. Dieter comes up to his original finishing station. Sturgis is closing down. 1.38. This young man from Leicester, he really is a powerhouse. It's as though they like the blue touch paper on the finishing lap, and Sturgis will not give in. He's absolutely sprinting like fury.
The conversation covers how he became disillusioned with life as a professional cyclist, to the point that he left the sport and went to university. Although he came back to the top level in 1998, riding the Commonwealth Games for England, it's only in relatively recent years that he's realised that much of his adult life has been spent coping with bipolar condition and anxieties.
Something that I think is a bit of a misconception is that people with a mental illness are mentally fragile. It's not. You know, my mental strength was always one of my strengths. You know, I could deal with pressure. I could deal with 12,000 people in a stadium shouting your name and screaming for you. I could deal with the pressure of Olympic finals, World finals, Commonwealth Games finals. That wasn't the problem. It was life in the background that was the problem.
So that was a clip from the two-part Colin Sturgis special. We've got another friend special coming out soon, which is my interview with Jean Bobet, covering the golden era of the 1950s, and that will be out very soon indeed. Certainly before the Tour de France, the next week or so. And you can become a friend of the podcast at thecyclingpodcast.com for £15. Thank you, everybody who has already signed up. That support really does help keep us on the road and go to the Tour de France, as we're about to do. The Tour of Switzerland was the other race that's just been run, and I mentioned earlier that has been a bit of a poor relation, typically won by Simon Asparagus the last few years. But it attracted a much stronger field this year. Why was that? There was a team time trial in it too, which was great, you know, for teams targeting the Tour de France, where there's a very important team time trial early on. But any clue as to why, you know, Richie Porte and others, Mikel Landa, went to the Tour of Switzerland this year?
It was purely the date, wasn't it, Rich? I think it's the fact that the Dauphiné this year finished 4 weeks from the start of the Tour de France, which most of the contenders decided was too much time, because most of them don't race again, or they'll only race the national championships, which is obviously a one-day race. And I think they wanted to have a stage race or compete in a stage race that was finishing a bit closer to the Tour.
It made for a good race as well, though, didn't it?
It did make for interesting race, Napalm. I mean, I was pretty impressed with Quintana. Obviously, you know, the prospect of Movistar, well, more than the prospect, they've confirmed that this is actually going to happen. They're going to go into the Tour de France with three leaders, Valverde, Quintana and Landa. A lot of speculation again about whether there is going to be any sort of hierarchy within that mini hierarchy of leaders. Is Quintana the anointed one in actual fact? He looked like it at the Tour of Switzerland. Landa was kind of marooned in the front group on a couple of occasions while Quintana sort of went off down the road and did his own thing. And he's never someone who looks particularly happy in that role, Mikel Landa, as we saw with Team Sky last year.
He's got a sort of melancholic face, though, hasn't he? I mean, the big, the heavy eyebrows and the... I mean, Landa's, he's always got one expression as well, and it's... He looks sort of...
dissatisfied.
Nonplussed.
Yeah.
He's immensely strong, but doesn't really change expression at all.
Well, he had a real go on one particular day as well, didn't he? And, you know, look really lively. But, of course, in that team, Movistar... Valverde has got the seniority, Quintana has got the kind of pedigree, and Lando is I think he could be in an even worse position than he was in last year with Team Sky. I mean, stuck with those two just ahead of him, I think, in the pecking order. You know, Lando could find, he's going to be like a firework trapped in a biscuit tin, isn't he? And it's whether or not he blows the lid off the biscuit tin and goes for it. He's been quoted as saying he hopes that the tour will be won by himself. So I mean, that doesn't exactly suggest that he's willing to lay it on the line for his two teammates. But of course, the road will decide. And Valverde's had a good result in the Route du Sud, or the what's it called now? Sorry,
Route Occitanie.
Ah, that's it. Yeah, it's excitingly rebranded. Quintana, of course, won a stage and finished third in the Tour de Suisse, and has had a... Well, he's had a very quiet season, really. Just popped up for two or three week-long stage races. We've had the suspicion in the past that he's come into the Tour a bit over-raced. This year, that certainly won't be the case. And Valverde, I mean, he, you know, what can you say about Valverde? I mean, he could quite easily finish in the top half a dozen. Not sure he could necessarily win the race, but while he is well-placed, you know, he has that seniority on his side.
Well, I spoke last week, or the week before last, to Alex Dowsett, the British rider who's just finished the Giro d'Italia for Katusha Alpecin. He joined that team this year from Movistar, and spoke to him for quite a long time, and we'll release that conversation at some point. But he said some interesting things about Movistar, I thought, and the culture at Movistar, and the idea of the three of those riders going in as joint leaders and how that might or might not work. Some of his observations about Movistar I thought were interesting, so let's hear some of them now.
You know, for the four of the five years I was with them, we were best team in the world. So, like, clearly doing... is the older saying, it's like two sayings: if it ain't broke, don't fix it. And there's also, like, the most dangerous term in business is we've always done it that way. So what they do works. And, you know, all the riders are very good. All the riders have grown up in mountainous regions and are very good. So it's, I mean, I talked a lot about the team time trial, like Team Sky's approach to a team time trial when I was there, and Movistar's approach. Team Sky was very clinical, like you knew what you were doing, you knew a long way in advance the turns you were doing, how long you were doing, what you were aiming for. Movistar, they decided the order as we rode to the start ramp, the order starting with Visconti because he was in Italy, and we were at Tirreno Adriatico, and then it was like, cool, off you go, fellas. I was then thinking, like, this is a shambles, we're going to be useless. And then we finished second, like, way ahead of Team Sky. And Team Sky, they haven't actually ever done that well in team time trials. Movistar was a lot looser. And coupled with that, the riders, there was no egos at all there. So everyone knew what they were good at and knew when to get off the front. And it wasn't a case of trying to hang on for that 10, 15 seconds because you want to do 45 seconds instead of 30. It was like, yeah, that's me done. I'm going to go to the back now because as a team, we might lose speed. And I think that was quite a big difference. There was no pressure. And as they never put pressure on us, Movistar. It was always like, when we get to a time trial, be like, you're going to win today, Alex. Or I'd be like, well, maybe. And they're like, nah, you're going to win. And I'd race, wouldn't win. They'd be like, yeah, you'll win next time. Like, it was a really cool vibe, a really cool environment, and clearly it's something that really works for them as well. You know, their tour this year is going to be super interesting if they're still taking Landa, Valverde and Nairo as part of an 8-man team. Like, that's going to be fascinating to see how that pans out.
I mean, that team seemed to lose its way and lose its leader when they lost Valverde last year. You know, in your experience of being around them, how important is he just as a presence on the team?
Yeah, Valverde's a, like, again, no ego Spaniard. He, one thing I noticed when I moved to Movistar is Valverde talks to the Neo Pro like he talks to Nairo, like he talks to Eusebio, the boss. Everyone's an equal, which is really cool. But yeah, Valverde, with what he can do, what he can win. I mean, look at it from a pure points standpoint. It's no secret that Valverde collects, like, most of the points from Movistar whilst we were there, like, when he had a couple of real sensational years. I think everyone was just more concerned because it was such a grim injury. Like, it was, you know, is he going to come back kind of injury. No one wants to see anyone's career end that way. It's like Pablo Lastras. Like, no one wanted to see him end his career like he did. So yeah, just hope for a full recovery. And yeah, you know, you're then going into, like, races like the Tour, sort of one very significant man down. Yeah, you know, huge shoes to fill by someone else.
Did you get to know Quintana well at all while you're there? He seems like quite a difficult guy to get to know.
Yeah, he keeps himself to himself a fair bit. Yeah, friendly, like, super friendly. We'd chat away. And you go, like, my strength being a TT and his strength being climbing, like, it was never, like, he'd ask me about time trialing, and I wouldn't really ask him much about climbing because you only have to look at the size of him to see how he goes up a hill so well. So yeah, Nairo was good. Like, the whole team were good.
How's that going to shake out? You don't know Landa so well, but how's it going to shake out between the three of them at the Tour, do you think?
Your guess is as good as mine. Like, you know, you look at Landa looking after Froome. Again, you had a situation like Froome and Wiggins where you had the domestique that was capable of being very competitive himself but still stayed loyal. So you're Valverde, who does, like, there's zero ego there at all. So yeah, I think those guys, Nairo, from reading, like, and all I've seen is what's in the press. I don't know anything from the inside, but when Landa joined the team, the way some of the interviews Nairo conducted, it's like, yes, I think it's a concern, possibly a concern for Nairo. He's had a couple of unlucky tours the last 2 years, so he's, you know, another big hit has come into the, like, a really big hit has come into the team, so it's possibly a slight worry for him, I'd say. How they all play together, wow.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Independent research shows 10% of sports nutrition products would get a professional rider banned. Trust Science in Sport, the world's highest standard of banned substance testing.
So we have a question this week for Science in Sport from Steve Wally. Good afternoon, great podcast. Thank you, Steve. Just a quick question on the older cyclist nutrition requirements. I'm 57 and I'm keen to know what ratio of macronutrients and the amounts I should be consuming per day. I cycle 25 to 100 miles per week, depending on the season. Strength train 2 to 3 times per week with heavy squat, bench, deadlift, bent over row type program. And I'm a keen walker, getting in my 10,000 steps most days.
Considering your lifestyle, you should aim to consume about 100 to 140 grams of protein per day from high biological value sources. So sources that really provide a lot of nutrition for the muscle. These are things like meat, fish, dairy products, whey protein, and legumes, so beans and peas. In terms of boosting your total daily protein intake, because that's more than most people eat, SIS whey protein and SIS advanced isolate would be a really convenient way to increase that. The amount of carbohydrate you need to consume will depend on your training volume and intensity, but you should focus on a combination of low and high GI carbohydrates. So the low GI carbohydrates would be things like fruits and vegetables, and the high GI sources would be potatoes, pasta, rice, and bread, and other things that are really most useful immediately after training to help refuel the muscle. For fat, it's a bit more complicated, as fat serves both as a fuel source and a structural component of body cells. It actually makes up the cell membrane. So we need sufficient diversity in the diet to provide the whole range of fats that we need in a cell membrane. So these are omega-3 fats, omega-6 fats, omega-9 fats. So just as a quick guide, you'll get some of the omega-3 fats from fish, for example, oily fish. The omega-6 fats typically come from vegetables, things like sunflower seeds or sunflower oil will have a lot of omega-6 in. And your omega-9 fats will come from things like olive oil. So it's really about getting the correct combination and diversity of fats in the diet rather than the total amount.
Thank you very much to Science and Sport for sponsoring the Cycling Podcast. You can get 25% off all your Science and Sport products at scienceofsport.com. with the code SISCP25. It was 30% during the women's tour, but it's now back down to 25%. Still a very generous offer. A reminder too to keep your questions coming to Science and Sports Nutrition Experts. Contact at thecyclingpodcast.com. We're meeting up with them again before the Tour de France, so we've got a few more questions to put to them. Lionel, Richie Port.
Yeah, an impressive week for Richie Port. He came under quite a lot of pressure on the final mountain stage, but held firm and won the Tour Switzerland overall. And when you think that it's been quite a long road back for him after that crash almost a year ago now on the descent of the stage to Chambéry in last year's Tour, you know, a tricky recovery from that. Port has not raced heavily, but when he has raced, he's got some pretty good results. Second at the Tour Down Under, third at the Tour of Romandy, and now winning the Tour de Suisse. So again, he's going to go into the Tour as one of the kind of the second tier favourites, as he did last year, really. People were talking up his potential friendship / rivalry with Chris Froome. The thing that interests me about BMC is that they have got a team that can put Port right into contention. There have been three team time trials at World Tour level so far this season. BMC have won two of them. And if you look back, I know it's 3 years ago now, but the team time trial in the Tour de France in Brittany 3 years ago, BMC won that by a second from Team Sky and 4 seconds from Movistar, and everyone else was quite a distance back, really. And you could see that sort of result in the Tour de France in Cholet. BMC, Sky and Movistar being the top three.
But the big question about BMC obviously concerns the future of the team. I think we'd know by now if there was likely to be good news. And, you know, when some of the top riders of the team, Greg Van Avermaet, for example, are openly saying that, you know, they're looking elsewhere and they have other options, it doesn't bode well for a team going into the Tour de France to support a rider who's never finished on the podium of a Grand Tour for all that he's capable of it. They're riding for their own futures as well, potentially.
Well, yeah, I mean, sorry, Van Avermaet, particularly potential winner of the stage to Roubaix. It might be a hard sell to ask him to sacrifice his own stage-winning chances for Richie Port, but we shall see. I mean, they're going to ride together in the team time trial. I think that's pretty certain. what better way really to attract a sponsor than to all be stood on the podium in Cholet, having won the stage. I mean, I get what you're saying, that, you know, individual ambitions might come into it, but if they've got the chance to win in the biggest bike race in the world, then it's not going to do them any harm, both collectively or individually, is it?
And one bright note as well from the Tour of Switzerland chaps, I thought, was TJ Van Garderen really sort of embracing the role of domestique. I mean, we talked last year about him being very out of sorts. He certainly was out of sorts at the Giro, and Team Sky Dave Brailsford thought about TJ Van Garderen as a possible future signing for Team Sky as a domestique, or as a kind of domestique deluxe. And I think at that time he had another year on his contract with BMC anyway, so this would be the final year anyway. But he certainly, I don't know whether he's reconciled himself to the idea of riding in that role at the Tour de France, or whether with Port looking so good, there was simply no other option in Switzerland. But if he can ride like that at the Tour de France, he'll be a real ally for Port. You guys, you mentioned the crash on the Mont du Chat, on the descent of the Mont du Chat last year, and I think that is a big hurdle for Port to get over as well, just the sort of mental scar tissue that's left, because the conditions were pretty poor that day, but I think it was a mistake, and hopefully that won't come back to haunt him at the Tour.
My feeling, though, is that Richie Port, he went into the Tour with such a build-up of expectation and hype around him, really, that this year, even though he's won the Tour of Switzerland here, which, you know, he didn't win the Dauphiné last year, though he went close, I feel like the expectation is much less around Richie Port, and he's going into the race with less pressure from that point of view, and that he may have an opportunity to ride gradually into the race in a way that he didn't last year. And he almost felt that mistake that he made on stage 9 last year was almost a result of the huge pressure that was on him, because there was a real sense that he might win the tour.
His career, his Grand Tour career, reminds me a little bit of Tony Rominger in the Indurain era. The Paul is to Chris Froome almost what Rominger was to Indurain, in the sense that there were 3 or 4 years, Napalm, you'll remember, was it 1994?
Yeah, 94.
I think 94 and... Well, 94, there was a lot of talk and speculation and a feeling in cycling that Rominger had the measure of Indurain going into that Tour de France. Then, of course, he won the... He led the Giro in 95 from start to finish, but it all came quite late in his career, and it's the same for Port, really, isn't it? I mean, he's not going to have that many more chances.
No, he's not, and I think the fact that he's not a prolific rider, really, in the sense, you know, that he gets a lot of wins, but so maybe the winning the Tour of Switzerland will give him the sort of boost that he needs. But we're what, 3 weeks away from the Tour de France? It feels like quite a long build-up, and it is, of course, a longer build-up from these two preparation races to the Tour this year. There's that extra week of anticipation and excitement. But I mean, I've drawn up a list of riders that you could think of who are their team leaders and would be a really solid shout for a top 10 place. And there's around 20 riders on my spreadsheet here.
Is this like your old World Cup wall chart?
A little bit, yeah. I'm going to eliminate them as they fall by the wayside, one by one. I'm going to mark through them on my spreadsheet with black. I'm going to black them out as they drop out of contention. But Port is in the top, you know, the top half of those, you know, behind Froome and Bardet and Nibali, I guess, and maybe even Dumoulin.
Napalm, on your Tour de France World Cup Cycling Podcast wall chart, where does Primoz Roglic figure?
Yeah, Primoz Roglic.
Well, he's kind of smack bang in the middle, really. He won the Tour of Slovenia, his home stage race, last week, overshadowed by the Tour de Suisse. Certainly not as tough a race. It's not as long, of course, and the field isn't as deep. But an impressive week-long stage race pedigree developing around Roglic. He's won the Tour of the Basque Country, or Itzulia, as it's now called, and the Tour of Romandy, and the Tour of Slovenia. But, I mean, there's a world of difference, isn't there, between winning a week-long stage race and winning the Tour de France. And if we're playing down Richie Port's Grand Tour credentials, then I think we have to be realistic about Roglic. But I think he's certainly a dark horse. And
they're saying that Kruiswijk's the leader.
Well, that's smart of them, isn't it? Because it deflects all of the attention away from Roglic. And Kruiswijk is on my list, but really a peripheral figure, I would say.
Well, I look forward to hearing more of this list in the days and weeks.
Lionel's list.
Leading up to the Tour de France. Fantastic.
Maybe I'll draw... Yeah, I'll maybe post it. I'll finish colouring it in and post it on social media.
Oh, wonderful. Look forward to that. Where does Dan Martin figure in your list?
Well, he's on there having had a bit of a shocker opening 4 or 5 months of the season, and then fourth place and a stage win at the Dauphiné. Daniel, we didn't really talk about him in the first part, but I thought he looked good and increasingly good as the race went on, and he raced in a trademark Dan Martin style, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. He's back on form. He's found he's rediscovered his mojo. I mean, he talked quite sort of poignantly, really, on the day of his stage win at the Dauphiné in the press conference. He did a very good press conference where he talked about how he'd lost his enjoyment in racing in the early part of this year. I think, you know, he went to UAE, there was talk of a big salary that he was or he is receiving there, and there's a certain amount of pressure with that. He's never really been a guy around whom a team has been constructed before. I think his position in UAE is the closest he's got to that in his career. So there was a fair bit of pressure, and that affected the way he approached the first part of the season. And then he went back and sort of regrouped in the spring, came back with a different attitude. And it was, like you say, Lionel, it was a typical Dan Martin performance. A lot of attacks in the last 4 or 5 kilometres of stages. You know, he's still someone who is going to suffer certainly in the team time trial and the individual time trial on the penultimate day, and he will lose time, and so much time, I would suggest, that it might take him out of contention for the win, even if he has a great a great race generally, but I think he's certainly a good bet for a stage win. Another question mark is whether Fabio Aru is going to go for the UAE team. Of course, he rode a really, really poor Giro, and he's been off having tests to see if he's got some kind of food intolerance or food allergy, and he might yet be slotted into the Tour team, which might not be great news for Dan Martin. But I think things looked up.
He's got a mountain allergy at the moment, Fabio.
Yeah,
Aru.
He
looks like he's got the heebie-jeebies every time the race goes uphill. Certainly in the Giro, he looked very... I mean, he's not an elegant rider, is he? But he looked really, really below par as soon as the race got tough at the Giro.
He did, yeah.
Dumoulin has declared himself fit and ready for the Tour. I should have mentioned when we heard Alex Dowsett earlier, Dowsett's another rider who rode the Giro who has, he said, put his hand up for the Tour de France. They've not confirmed their team yet, Katusha Alpecin, but they're one of those teams that'll be going with two ambitions to support Zaccarini, Ilner Zaccarin, and Marcel Kittel. But lots to talk about the next couple of weeks leading up to the Tour. We should wrap things up for week, shouldn't we?
There's a whole host of riders we haven't even mentioned.
We'll
from
get
the, from the wall chart.
We'll work through Lionel's list.
Yeah.
Leave ourselves something to talk about next week.
Yeah. If we carry on at this rate, all we'll have left to talk about and the week before the Tour is whether Ilner Zaccarin can win. And the answer to that is no.
Oh, don't write him off, Lionel. Daniel, thank you very much.
Thank you, chaps.
Speak to you next week.
Will do.
Thank you, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.